Bloomberg On the Economy with Mike McKee and Carol Masser.
One of my favorite people, I love talking with him.
Oh, thank you, Carol.
You're so welcome. It's Josh Rosner. He is managing director, bank analyst over at Graham Fisher & Company. He is, though, a specialist in the housing industry. Great book that he wrote with Gretchen Morgenson of The Times, Reckless Endangerment. So if you haven't read it, you should check it out. So, Mr. Rosner, housing market, everything's wonderful?
Well, housing market... you know, we've got all this reliance on that we're going to return to some historic norm. And when you hear everyone talk, they talk about the empirical data, but they only go back to 1945, 1950. And the reality is the housing market today looks more like it did prior to World War II, and reliance on post-World War II data doesn't really help us. This is an aberrational or a completely abnormal cycle.
So get it out of your mind.
So get it out of your mind. Stop looking at housing to resume its more recent trajectory. Stop looking and thinking about a housing recovery and start recognizing that what we've got is a bottoming process, but that bottoming process could end with really a new normal. We've got generational headwinds. We've got structural headwinds that really need to be considered and really need to be part of the public dialogue, especially vis-a-vis our relationship with housing.
Nobody's really getting their head around that. I agree with you. If you look just at the demographics in terms of the aging baby boomers, and then, you know, I've looked into the folks in college who are coming out with so much debt.
Well, that's
how
right.
The heck are they going to be able to afford a home?
Especially since, take those two issues, which are very real issues, and think about them in a different context. I call it the headwinds. Or the tailwinds reversing, which is part of consumption over the past 40 years has been supported by, in a very real way, the democratization of credit that began in the late 70s, where asset prices, food prices, commodity prices broadly were outpacing income growth. And so we really – that was the beginning of innovation of credit cards,
right,
of consumer revolving credit. That revolving credit supported consumption since that period. Add to that, we had the largest generation in American history entering their peak earning years coming out of the recession of the early 80s. That supported consumption. The social trend of women going into the workforce en masse, which began as a social movement in the early 70s, accelerated in the late 70s again, where asset prices and commodity prices are outstripping wages. All three of those are now headwinds.
Right. Those were strong trends.
Strong trends.
Then.
That's right.
Now
and
headwinds.
Now they're flipping.
Right.
Add to that that we've had largely interest rates falling since that period. Well, there's not a whole lot further they can fall. And remember, when interest rates finally go up, what does that mean for house prices?
Right.
Okay, so you've got those features. Now, let's then go to more structural issues in housing specifically, which would include household formation. Household formation trends are terrible. And the only areas where you're seeing household formation growth is above 54 years and older.
Right.
But 54 and over are already at 70% plus home ownership
rates. They've got their homes. They're thinking about retirement villages.
So that's exactly right. Now, household formation on the lower end, okay, on the under 30, is negative, and it's been negative, and it will continue to be negative. Now, add to that that population, home ownership rates are under 20. That's a large part of our potential home buying pool, but they're saddled with $1 trillion in student debt. Okay. They also are the first generation since World War II to have a behaviorally different relationship with housing. There isn't this belief, which has persisted since World War II,
right,
that home prices always rise. So we have a lot of headwinds that we need to contend with. So are we seeing a bottoming? Absolutely. Have we seen a bottom in prices? I don't think we're there yet, because remember, we had a lot of foreclosures that were held off the market. And only with the settlement, the AG 50-state settlement, which will allow foreclosures to now commence,
right,
are we seeing servicers ramp up to actually foreclose? And so come third quarter, fourth quarter, early next year, we'll start seeing those come to market. Now, there's another problem. 28% of all home sales last year, 28% of all home sales last year were investment properties.
Okay. I got to tell you, I was in Tampa earlier this year, and I was surprised to see investors back buying properties under 100K, and there were bidding wars.
That's right. And so that's a big piece of what we're seeing. When more than a quarter—
And so that skews what we're seeing. In terms
it,
of the
not
market.
Only does it skew what we're seeing, but a lot of them are buying them with the expectation of either flipping them 5 years from now or turning them into rentals. Well, if you're living in a house it's got a utility value. Your family is there. Your job is there. Right. You're staying there.
Right.
If you're buying it to rent, you've got an expected return. Okay. And if your cap rate assumption is 8% in 4 years from now, it turns out that it's coming in at 4%. Are you going to hold the property? You're going to sell the property. And
right.
if you're going to sell the property, where are interest rates at that point? Okay. So there's a lot of risk. Now, that part is a regional phenomenon. Okay. But there's a lot of risks that I think people really aren't considering. And, you know, I think housing medium term, long term has some real problems as those older age cohorts do start moving.
I mean, we're going to have tremendous supply. We already have a lot of supply
right.
out there.
That's right.
I mean, that whole idea of blowing up a million homes or something, I still think that that's a good idea. You've got to get rid of the supply.
Well, I think I actually would put it a little – I would think about it a little differently.
Of course you would.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, we've had a big part of the feature that supported consumption in real estate for the past many years has been the mortgage interest deduction, which really supports leverage.
Yeah, yeah.
It supports you buying as much home as you can possibly get financing for.
Right.
Which is different than buying the home that you need and using it as it historically was used, which is a savings account.
Right.
Okay. So if we turn the mortgage interest deduction into, let's say, an equity principal tax credit, so each year that you pay down your principal, you get a tax credit, okay? You would be building savings, which A, adds stability to the housing market.
Mm-hmm.
B, it reduces the ultimate burden that we'll face on the social safety net, as those boomers retire with no equity in their homes and therefore have to rely on Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. But we're not doing that, okay? So I think we're really not addressing the problems. On top of that, we haven't even talked about, in all of these problems, the fact that financial intermediation in the mortgage market came through third-party originators who are all gone.
Right.
And the private label securitization market, which is still broken. So we're relying on banks who have no interest in putting 30-year assets on their books at rates where they are.
Right, which we've seen
right.
very clearly.
Fannie and Freddie, who are trying to reduce their risk. And really, therefore, it's all on the government's shoulders directly.
To me, it sounds like a broken market.
It's a broken market.
Talking with Josh Rosner. He is bank analyst, managing director at Graham Fisher & Company. We've been talking a lot about the housing market. I want to shift gears and talk a little bit more about Fannie and Freddie. Joining the conversation on the phone is Chuck Gabriel. He's president, managing director, and founder of Capital Alpha Partners. So, Chuck, good morning.
Morning. Thank you.
Great to have you here. So we've been talking about housing with Josh, and we kind of ended saying it was a broken market. How do you see housing at this point?
Recovering a bit. You know, unfortunately,
I got to tell you, Josh just smiled on that.
Yeah, I know.
Is it actually recovering, Chuck, or is it just, you know, not falling?
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of bobbing along.
Yeah, I guess when you're, you know, on roller skates going backwards, the slowest guy wins. there does seem to be some bottoming in some of the, some of the Sand State markets that have been most depressed. But I agree with Josh. It's going to be a long, long process. But, you know, I'm sure one of the topics that you're talking about today is that the regulatory uncertainty and a number of the concerns that Washington has generated have really contributed to that. With regard to this adverse credit condition has certainly been compounded by what's been going on in Washington on a policy basis.
And we did get some news this week. You know, Josh and I were talking about it in the break. I mean, Josh, in terms of Fannie and Freddie, the Treasury Department revamping its financial support of Fannie and Freddie, what does this mean?
Well, what does it mean? It's got a number of meanings. First of all, it means that the government has a greater interest in Fannie and Freddie returning to profitability as quickly as they can, because what they did is they eliminated the dividend. Fannie and Freddie were required to pay a dividend to Treasury for all of their borrowings.
And that's been kicking back a bunch of money.
And that's been kicking back money, but it's also been increasing, therefore, the cost to Fannie and Freddie and the receivership.
And taxpayers.
Theoretically, it's intended to reduce the ultimate cost.
Okay.
But yes, it increases the tab. So what they did is they eliminated that and they said, going forward, we're just going to take any profits that you get, sweep them right into Treasury.
Straight to the government.
Straight to the government, thereby functionally nationalizing the companies. They essentially just wiped out any value, residual value for equity holders, and wiped out any residual value for the private preferred holders, which, if you remember back in 2008, they decided not to nationalize these companies.
Right.
Well, they just functionally nationalized them, having let those equity holders and preferred holders believe for a while that there might be some value to
their
holdings.
So they got screwed, basically.
That's right. Now, there's
Excuse
a couple French. Of other questions that go with that. In nationalizing them, have they made it impossible ever to really recoup the money? Unless we decide that Fannie and Freddie are really going to be a forever feature of the government housing programs, so that it's going to be Fannie, Freddie, and Ginnie all as government, you know, businesses going forward.
Right.
Otherwise, they've just really made it very hard for them ever to see a path to recover the losses that are embedded in Fannie and Freddie. Which, you know, so the whole question of, you know, do they end up reprivatized with a new charter? Do they end up, you know, repaired and become part of the restructuring of that broken market? That sort of was answered last week.
Right, by the government,
by
basically
the government.
Saying.
Right.
Chuck, what do you think about what we heard?
And it's just amazing. You know, I didn't write a book about it like Josh did, so I'll throw my thoughts out. But, you know, one of the reasons that you've had such a difficult environment to really move housing reform, and the administration has you know tried to deal with Fannie and Freddie and the issue of underwater, you know, 11 to 13 million underwater borrowers through an alphabet soup full of programs, literally 14 different programs, but you know has tried to run Fannie and Freddie flat out as more or less as wards of the state to get us through this housing crisis, but has really not wanted to debate reform much because Republicans have always been at the ready to blame Fannie and Freddie as being at the epicenter of the crisis and the Democrats for coddling Fannie and Freddie. So, you know, one of the great ironies is that as one of our colleagues, Peter Wallison, points out, he really believes that Geithner has signaled for now a couple of years that he's never wanted to let the GSE survive conservatorship to merge as private companies. So I think this move really caught a lot of people off guard, certainly did me. And in essence, it really does probably preclude the notion of Fannie or Freddie ever reemerging as private companies. And it doesn't necessarily preclude Congress getting engaged now, you know, with a new reform plan about what to do in the future, a la, you know, the Isaacson bill in the Senate, or what Paul Ryan and what Scott Garrett have proposed in the House. But I think Republicans are a little angry in Congress because it's the administration essentially checking the box on finally having proposed something beyond the three wish list proposals they had put out last year, might even give the White House some standing to try to, join arms with the Senate Democrats to try to exhort Republicans to pass, the Menendez mortgage refi bill perhaps in September. But it really was an amazing, amazing move, and it kind of takes us to the next phase of the debate about what to do with the GSEs.
And at the same time, you know, just so that it's understood, nothing here changes the obligations of their regulator, FHFA, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, as conservator. Their role as conservator is congressionally mandated. It's legislated to be.
Still intact.
That they are conserving the assets of the companies, which means that it doesn't mean just because the government now has functionally nationalized them that the government can do whatever they want with them and force them to do principal write-downs, etc. The conservator, which is Ed DeMarco, who's the head of the regulator, has really been one of the last great public servants. Whether we agree or disagree whether that we should do principal write-downs or refis in mass is sort of a side issue, and essentially his answer to it has been, look, I'm not a politician, but I'm following my chartered mandate, which is to conserve the assets, and I think that would be a negative move for doing so. And so Congress at some point has the right to go back and say, you know what, Fannie and Freddie should do principal write-downs. Fannie and Freddie should do mass refis, but it'll take Congress
to
happen, not this nationalization that we just saw.
I mean, Fannie and Freddie, I mean, you could debate whether or not we need a Fannie and Freddie, or whether we needed one. We've got one. We've got to deal with
That's
it.
That's right.
So what's, Chuck, let me bring you back in. I mean, what do you see as the future here? I mean, are we going to have a Fannie and Freddie for a long time? Do we need to have it in terms of the housing market? Do we not have a choice at this point because we're so in it so deeply?
Well, we certainly need one in the near term, and any transition away from them has to be gradual. And to their credit, most of the reformers have proposed a gradual move. But you know, what's interesting is politically, the administration's move, the Treasury, FHFA move here, to some extent, you know, just even though it does clear the way for reform if Congress can get there in the next, in the 114th Congress, I suppose. For the most part, it puts everything we continue to gurgle along, and Fannie and Freddie will probably continue to, along with FHA, to generate about a 90% market share. And if we have the kind of status quo election result that it looks like we might have, where the president's reelected and maybe even the Democrats keep the Senate, you know, we're probably going to measure the time it takes to truly consider legitimate reform of the GSEs in Congresses, two-year Congresses, rather than years. So, you know, it's just an interesting political move. It's you know, Josh and I have been watching Fannie and Freddie for a long time and holding hands with some of the equity shareholders and commiserating with their debt holders over the years. It's really certainly one for the history books, but it's certainly not going to impact, thankfully, mortgage borrowers. It doesn't preclude a debate about what we do going forward, but we'll certainly get a more interesting and perhaps more productive debate about that if we have a rightward shift after November, because Republicans are more bent to reform the GSEs rather than just to let sort of nationalize them in place as the equivalent of a Ginnie Mae, as you described earlier.
You know, I look at the $188 billion roughly that was put into Fannie and Freddie. I mean, as a taxpayer, do we ever, Josh, see that money back, or it's not going to come back?
Well, I mean, that's what I was saying, is I think in some sense the decision that was made last week really reduces the likelihood that we'll ever see it back. And there's, frankly, there's a lot of Republicans who have the attitude of, you know what, it's losses. They're losses that are part of this fiasco and the crisis. And we'd rather have it right than get the money back. And so that's, you know, that's part of the thought process. At the same time, if there's a viable way to get the money back, we probably should be pursuing that.
And they were starting to report profits.
They are right. And if home prices continue to rise, if the broader economy continues to perform, that will be an increasing reality. Now, you also have to remember that, A, that's going to be on a smaller book of business because they're running off their book, and B, frankly, part of the reason that they're showing increasing profits is, one, they're increasing the guarantee fees that they charge, but two, they're adversely selecting FHA. So the better quality borrowers are the ones that they're approving, and everyone else ends up going to FHA. So if you look at the leverage in their current book,
right,
the average loan-to-value of a Fannie Freddie borrower today is only about a 65 LTV. So there's only about 5% of Fannie and Freddie's current book that even requires private mortgage insurance, which is down from 22-23%.
That's a big difference.
Right at the crisis.
Right.
So they are, but it's also because they've tightened the credit box considerably, which has implications, obviously, for the broader housing market.
Hey, Chuck, you know, Josh, earlier we talked a lot about the demographics, the changing demographics of the housing market, and it's going to be a very different market going forward. It's not going to be the market that we've known for, 50, 60 years. Mm-hmm. You agree?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting about how, you know, one of the reasons if we are seeing a bottoming in housing, it may be because you're seeing some support from comps with rentals, you know. and I think, you know, one of the things that I think Josh would have needled me, you know, about as being having been a supporter of the Fannie Freddie story and what they did, as I was, 5-6 years ago, was the notion that, you know, home ownership was sacred and that politically it was going to be really to the peril of anyone who would take it on. But, you know, that concept of home ownership is, it's certainly not the great pedestal. It's not on the great pedestal it used to be. And for a lot of people, rentals are better. And
Home sweet home has got a very different notion today. It's
amen.
Definitely changed.
Absolutely.
Amen.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, we could certainly continue, and hopefully we can get you back soon, because obviously the Fannie Freddie and the housing story will continue for some time. Chuck Gabriel, President, Managing Director, and Founder of Capital Alpha Partners, joining us on the phone in studio.
Listen to Bloomberg on the Economy weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2012.